About being a member of our armed forces. Now, there should be a note with this poem. I was in the Air Force 6 years, and I eventually reached the rank of sergeant, and then I was demoted to corporal, and then I was demoted again back to LAC. That's in this poem, but there are a couple of terms in it, like zombies, who were the conscripts of the last war, and the quacks were the women soldiers, and what else? That's about it. About being a member of our armed forces. Remember the early days of the phony war, when men were zombies and women were quacks, and they used wooden rifles in the firing range? Well, I was the sort of soldier you couldn't trust with a wooden rifle. When they gave me a wooden bayonet, life was fraught with peril for my brave comrades, including the sergeant instructor. I wasn't exactly a soldier, though, only a humble airman, who kept getting demoted and demoted and demoted to the point where I finally saluted civilians. And when they trustingly gave me a Sten gun, Vancouver should have trembled in its sleep. For after I fired a whole clip of bullets at some wild ducks under Burrard Bridge on guard duty at midnight, they didn't fly away for 5 minutes, trying to decide if there was any danger. Not that the war was funny. I took it and myself quite seriously, the way a squirrel in a treadmill does, too close to tears for tragedy. Too far from the banana peel for laughter. And I didn't blame anyone for being there. The wars happened. Wasn't anybody's fault then. Now I think it is. Sergeant Jackson. In the long grass, lying there in 1944, hating that sergeant for thinking three stripes made him so superior he could get away with anything. Peering through the long grass at him, hoping his face might alter, flush or grow pale, and he might double over with agony from the force in my eyes. Voodoo thoughts of an LAC, trying to make the self-important bastard throw up his dinner, contract any ailment untrivial, like a permanent dose of clap, or imaginary fleas approximately the size of rats. A big eagle circling the sun, with eyes a golden snare, looped round the green valley. Snow peaks overhead, dust blowing past the airfield, the Skeena sailing. I screwed that up. A big eagle circling the sun, with eyes a golden snare, loop round the green valley. Snow peaks overhead, dust blowing across the airfield, the Skeena sailing past. Railway tracks heading for Rupert. 48-hour pass cancelled, myself stuck there forever. For even the Japs would be welcome, but they have more sense. No woman for miles. All this a long time ago. I remember grass tickling my chin, mountains high and near and far away, axe blows smashing at silence, Indian canoes on the Skeena, totem poles, and some friends. Nothing is lost. That sergeant? I convince no one now, even myself, that I hated him, but my hate was holy and beautiful then, and it replaced love for 3 months. He deserved the best. Last summer, I spent about 2 months in Newfoundland in a camper, or at least we went there in a camper, and I wrote about 5 or 6 poems about Newfoundland. This is about the, I believe it's the only authenticated Viking site in North America, on the Great Northern Peninsula of Newfoundland. This is coming back. Over the hills in the rain, my dear. We are walking back from the Viking site. It must be about 4 miles, and rain beats on us, soaks into our clothes, runs into our shoes, makes white pleats in our skin, turns hair into decayed seaweed. And I think sourly that drowning on land is a hell of a slow way to die. I walk faster than my wife, then have to stop and wait for her. It isn't much farther, I say encouragingly, and note that our married life is about to end in violence, judging from her expressionless expression. Again I slop into the lead, then wait in the mud till she catches up, thinking, I gotta say something encouraging. You sure are a sexy-looking mermaid, dear. That doesn't go down so good either, and she glares at me murderously. At which point I've forgotten all about the rain. trying to manufacture a verbal comfort station, a waterproof two-seater. We squelch miserably into camp about half an hour later, stripped down like white shriveled slugs, waving snail horns at each other, cool neuter antennae, assessing the other ridiculous creature. And I begin to realize one can't use a grin like a band-aid or antidote for reality, at least not all the time. And maybe it hurts my vanity to know she feels sorry for me. But to be a fool is sometimes my own good luck. Newfoundland rain. It is raining in this country of green spruce. A damn sad rain. It mourns itself into my mood. There's a leaky toilet somewhere around Eridanus and the Horse Nebula, directly in line with my gravel quarry. Not even a happy bum on the dirt road nearby, hitting me up for a glass of beer, giving rise to reflections of a moral nature. The country is too poor to support bums. Everyone has to work or die. And rain drives the message home into leaky roofed houses where shining-eyed little girls ask questions about Santa Claus, who is out at sea in a leaky dory, catching cod at 4.5 cents a pound, and smiles courageously at his maker, quoting the Old Testament at water, threatening the waves with hellfire. While I watch the rain, sadly camped in a gravel quarry, water rising outside, along with the cost of living, and everything leaks. The road to Newfoundland. My foot has pushed a fire ahead of me for 1,000 miles. My arm's response to hills and stones has stated parallel green curves deep in my unknown country. The clatter of gravel on fenders registers on a ghostly player piano inside my head with harsh, fraying music. I'm lost to reality. I turn the steering wheel a quarter inch to avoid a bug on the road. A long time's way here since Stone Age man carried the fire germ in a moss-lined basket from camp to camp and prayed to it, as I shall solemnly hold Henry Ford and all his descendants accountable to the 24,000-mile guarantee. Well, there are many miles left before it expires, and several more to the next rest stop, and I kick the fire ahead of me with one foot, even harder than before, hearing the sound of burning forests muffled in steel, toppling buildings, history accelerating, racing up and down hills with my flesh taken captive, grown steel claws on a mindless composite creature wanting speed and more speed. Stop at a calm lake embossed with 2-inch waves. Sit there a few minutes without getting out of the car, my heart a hammering drum among the trees and grass roots, August diminuendo, watching the composed landscape and the deliberate sun in its slow dance through space. Then drive steadily north with the captive fire toward the next camp. The Runners. There's a quote from Eric the Red's saga that more or less explains what follows. Quote, "It was when Leif was with King Olaf Tryggvason, and he bade him proclaim Christianity to Greenland, that the king gave him 2 Gaels. The man's name was Heki, the woman's Hekia. The king advised Leif to have recourse to these people, if he should stand in need of fleetness, for they were swifter than deer. Eric and Leif had tendered Karlsefni the services of this couple. Now, when they had sailed past Marvel Strands to the New World, they put the gales ashore, and directed them to run to the southward, and investigate the nature of the country, and return again before the end of the third half day." From Eric the Red Saga. "Brother, the wind of this place is cold, and hills under our feet tremble. The forests are making magic against us. I think the land knows we are here. I think the land knows we are strangers. let us stay close to our friend the sea. Our cunning dwarves at the roots of darkness shall seize and drag us down. Sister, we must share our strength between us until the heat of our bodies makes a single flame, and one that we are is more than two that we wear, while the moon sees only one shadow, and the sun knows only our double heartbeat, and the rain does not come between. Brother, I am afraid of this dark place. I am hungry for the home islands, and wind blowing the waves to colored spray. I am sick for the sun. Sister, we must not think those thoughts again, for 3 half days have gone by. We must return to the ship. If we are away longer, the Northmen will beat us with thongs until we cry for death. Why do you stare at nothing? Brother, a cold wind touched me, though I stand in your arms' circle. Perhaps the Northmen's runes have found us, the runes they carve on wood and stone. I am afraid of this dark land, ground mist that makes us half ghosts, and another silence inside silence. But there are berries and fish here, and there are worse things than silence. Let us stay and not go back. Sister, we should die slowly. The beasts would gnaw at our bodies, the rains whiten our bones. The Northmen's runes are strong magic, the runes would track us down, though we keep on running, past the land of flat stones, over the marble strands, beyond the land of great trees, though we ran to the edge of the world, our masters would crack us down. Brother, take my hand in your hand, this part of ourselves between us, while we run together, over the stones of the seacoast, this much of ourselves is our own, while rain cries out against us, and darkness swallows the evening, and morning moves into stillness, and mist climbs to our throats, while we are running, sister. Lance Omedos. This is about the Viking site too. Newfoundland. They're building the road right under our wheels for $1.25 an hour and no overtime along the Viking coast to the outports for the benefit of some isolated fishermen, not to mention the tourist dollar. The metropolis of St. Anthony, 2500 pop, is only about 25 miles away. Most people have never been there or seen the bright lights like dewdrops among the potatoes. Until the road came, the sea and death were their only exits. I carry 3 suitcases from the new road for a girl who works in St. Anthony and hasn't been home in 3 years. She says thank you at the house door, and I turn back on the muddy path, wondering what her parents are like. Are they old and silvery as bleached wood, peering out behind curtains? Are they curious about the tall stranger escorting their changeling daughter? A young man with blue eyes and blonde hair, whose ship stood in the sea roads 1,000 years ago. Maybe him for whom the tourists blare their horns, look out there at sheep and cows, hoping to catch a glimpse of him from one corner of their eyes. The blue-eyed foreigner escorting a girl from St. Anthony home to her aged parents. But his back is turned, and it isn't me they're looking for. Louisbourg Fortress reconstructed. This is being made a national park right now, and a great deal of money being spent today as well. Louisbourg Fortress. So much money spent here in 1719 that Louis XV across the sea in France said he expected to wake up one morning and see the walls rising above the horizon. A pleasant conceit among the courtiers, but 3,000 miles away in Canada, Louisbourg was a bloody metaphor for death. Tramping around the grassy breastworks in 1966, the Chateau St. Louis and King's Bastion rising again on this gray horizon, with a shrill wind waving the spruce trees, pausing at the tombstone of Israel Newton, who expected to die a long way south, the 1,000 unmarked graves of the Colonial Army from New England, where there isn't a single fat old general, not even a small one. And thinking about the money saved 250 years ago by corrupt contractors who built walls of saltwater masonry, fell apart under British cannon. A visitor in his imagination may see the court of the Sun King at Versailles, and the palace guard in gorgeous uniforms drawn up for inspection. If the visitor's ear is slightly attuned, he may hear the rattle of death in the throat of a farm boy from Massachusetts, and the hoarse gasp of a young fisherman from Brittany, where the grass is soft and green, and the French fought the English so bitterly long ago. They never expected to meet here. In the still listening intervals before the long sea rollers crash like guns. The names of things. In spring woods we dug the violets, transplanting them to cedar shade, white hats of lilies in the garden, red peonies, whose sweetness the ants love, shining red flashlights through the darkness. Our willow cuttings grew roots in water, and draw the sky down and up into leaves, along with splintered shapes of fish. On windless nights we crossed millions of miles of space, and touched stars with names they don't remember, and paused before the effort of saying Nova over and over again, among rumored collisions on purple mornings, those great masses of dead stone. Our soundless storms and fire oceans were altered without their knowledge. The trail beyond the village is still open. The maps of our comings and goings are whispers, are the place that sound has been, and left more empty and waiting for something to rush in, breathless, listen, listen, and the rubbing of dust together. The woodchuck knows some of them, where she crouches, trembling, with her blind children. The orange bird in her timeless swinging nest in the elm tree knows some of them, and for a long time they remain by the little lake, and the tumble-down cottage, and the church spire tangled in silence after we're gone. Private property. Not the Stone Age or bronze or small excitement of finding an arrowhead that once stopped a deer mid-stride to breathe the blood bubble. Just a pile of rocks of an old house foundation, stone furniture fallen inward, overlaid with worn-out tires and tin cans of an early 19th century farmhouse. But in the space I happened to occupy, 1,000 things happened, or just one, with me at the moving end. Under the hot sun, I rummage in the earth as if it were a clothes closet, poke a stick into crevices, shove rocks aside and dirty my hands, move a half-buried rotten timber. A snake flickers his tongue at me, underneath in the earth, what's left of an iron latch that doesn't stop anyone. 100-year-old bone comes sizzling grease from an oven with teeth marks of dogs, and a little piece of blue china from someone's dinner set. I hear a voice down there. Enoch, you clean that up. I never saw such a boy to break things. A blond, freckly boy, maybe, gathers the colored fragments under the eyes of his angry mother for a knife-edged moment of grief that slams his door to the future. I hear a voice above me. What you doing there? This is private property. That voice is the one last detail needed to slam the rusty iron latch and freeze me into a boy's grief. Twist the world to a halt. But then I notice another detail. Cow shit in someone's boots up there. A man wearing faded overalls, and say, sorry, I was just curious, wondering about the people who lived here. I walk to the road, among stones and blue thistles in the sky, and slow, suspicious stare of the farmer, one metal button gone from his bib, and the family underground, going on and on. Dandelion wine. Feels them, cat's eyes, all staring. I love that yellow. Would like to roll naked there and say, ingratiatingly, young ladies, I want to go to bed with you. How about it? Don't be vulgar, they answered. Beer-colored flowers? I must have you on paper. Cover the walls yellow. Turn the trees jaundiced. My skin to glow in the dark. My dear young ladies, after 6 bubbling weeks, I'll drink you all down with drowned ants for flavoring, and roots will spring from my feet, fire burst from my head. I'll grow 20 feet tall. I shall be one with Buddha, the Empyrean. There's nothing like the Empyrean to entertain visitors. Beothuk Indian skeleton in glass case, St. John's Museum, Newfoundland. 6 feet 3 inches, a man of 40. Not made for crawling on his belly, surely. The sight of this walking sunset must have amazed white pygmies from fog-bound fishing villages of Jobat's arm and famished gut before they tracked him down. He's the same height I am, which makes me speculate he'd have the same bother with low doorways and car seats and keep bumping his head on things. Never stand face to face with a girl and have to lie down with her to be properly friends. That's as far as it goes. My death is some way off yet, and enemies blend with the landscape. I gawk at the gawking tourists over this last symbol of his extinct nation. Consider the great ox and plants of the remote Carboniferous, and man-apes hitchhiking across the cosmos. I ought to feel sadness here, but can't. Only a slight amazement at the gawking tourists. But these specimens survived. The man in the glass case didn't. Incidentally, the Beothuks of Newfoundland were wiped out by white men about the middle of the last century, and there are no Indians now in Newfoundland. This was one of the last specimens. Last year's cabbages in a field near Stouffville, Ontario. Gray heads protruding at spaced intervals for 10 acres of April earth. From a distance they acquire human features, a mouth and eyes, with a patient expression. But stepped on, they give a rotten squelch, like dead men buried to their necks, a defeated army, tortured by their enemies, and left there awaiting marching orders that never come. But fantasy aside, I hate so much waste, my own or another's, and keep thinking about it on the road home, resolving then and there, when I die, to donate my body to science all the way to Toronto. Dominion Day, Sackville Street, Toronto. A red rain has fallen overnight on gray streets, mingling with young chestnut leaves like a red-green wedding. If you could change the firecrackers back to their original purchase price, then the street would be covered with dimes and nickels, the noise unsold. Next day, all this red paper makes me think of the H-bomb, which is silly, I guess, because firecrackers are jubilati, jubilati to neighborhood kids. Each red scrap stands for a 10-year-old boy's freckled grin. A happy little girl's clap hands, clap hands. Clap hands all together then, in the red rain, my darling children, and maybe you, or damn it, someone, can hear as well the faint, unfunny, beginning adult chuckle of nuclear laughter, which also stands for something, at least it does beforehand. William Lyon Mackenzie. In nervous sleep and snoring silence, Mackenzie's rebels at 5 a.m., and maybe a horse left outside the stable at Montgomery's Tavern, saddled and then forgotten, with the silver glitter of frost on exposed brown leather, as there is on the red, blue, green, pink, black, and yellow metal, roofs of cars parked in the street outside Maple Leaf Gardens. The sight of a comic rebellion, and the toenails of a dead man whose boots were gone also glittered in Mrs. William Sharp's back garden under the shining moon, while she watched the corpse to make sure it behaved itself. Nearly a century and a half later, the same moon on the feet of a soldier whose boots were stolen not long after death in Vietnamese jungles. Now the sun rises, and armies are on the move. Winemaker's Beat Etude. This is the first poem in the book. I am picking wild grapes last year in a field, dragging down great lianas of vine, tearing at 20 feet of heavy infinite purple, having a veritable tug-of-war with Bacchus, who grins at me delightedly in the high branches of one of those stepchild apple trees, unloved by anything but tent caterpillars, and ghosts of old settlers, become such strangers here. I am thinking what the grapes are thinking, become part of their purple mentality. That is, I am satisfied with the sun, an eventual fermenting bubble talk together, then transformed and glinting with colored lights in a great Jeroboam that booms inside from the land beyond the world. In fact, I am satisfied with my own shortcomings, letting myself happen, and I am surrounded by cows, black and white ones with tails. At first I'm uncertain how to advise them, in mild protest, or frank, manly invective. Then realize that the cows are right. It's me that's the trespasser. Of course they are curious, perhaps wish to see me perform. I moo off key. I bark like a man, laugh like a dog. I talk like God, hoping they'll go away so Bacchus and I can get on with it. Then I get logical. Thinking if there was ever a feminine principle, cows are it, and why not? But what would so many females want? I address them like Brigham Young hastily. No, that's out. I won't do it. Absolutely not. Contentment steals back among all this femininity. Thinking cows are together so much they must be nearly all lesbians, fondling each other's dugs by moonlight. Why, Sappho's own star-reaching soul shines inward and outward from the soft Aegean islands in these eyes, and I am dissolved like a salt lick instantly. Oh, sodium chloride, prophylactic acid, gamma particles, in suspension, aftershave lotion, rubbing alcohol. Suddenly, I become the whole damn feminine principle, so happily noticing little tendrils of affection steal out from each to each, unshy, honest, encompassing golden calves in Israel and slum babies in Canada, and a millionaire's brat left squalling on the toilet seat in Rockefeller Center. Oh, my sisters, I give purple milk. Dylan. I read him on the bus going back and forth to work in Vancouver in 1954. Getting my feet stepped on in a parable of green chapels, told to move on back in the car by a critical conductor. And girls like Hansel and Gretel and maybe Catlin gave me some dirty looks and a glare on Clark Drive and Hastings East, reading Dylan over and over till I didn't understand much better, standing in Kingsway rain, queuing up forever and ever, and looking down the front of girls' dresses and the force that threw the green pews. His level to get the strap hanger's face slapped, and he gets off at the wrong stop, and goes to work in the wrong factory, and one of us is living the wrong lifetime, just neither here nor there, of course, without understanding in the least, best a little drunk, with time and words not knowing any good reason for Vancouver in 1954.